One Filipino's journey from singer to sex guru to government spokeswoman.
It's fappening in Singapore.
Two's a pair, but three's a marriage in Malaysia.
Is Hong Kong reaching the bottom of its second act?
And we get answers to the unending haze crisis.
Welcome to the Coconuts Podcast, our look at the latest and greatest reporting from our eight newsrooms in Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. I'm Todd Rees, and I'm the managing editor of Coconuts Bangkok.
And I'm associate editor Tara Kamaltanavith.
Welcome to October.
Someone better wake Green Day up. I knew that was a bad joke while I was saying it, but I stand by it.
You're trying to cheapen what is in my, completely unbiased opinion, the greatest month of the year.
I love this month, too. Oh, it's a very special day today.
Look, October begins, and again, I'm totally the least self-obsessed person there is, obviously. But the month begins with my birthday.
It does.
And it ends with Halloween.
And accidentally, it is his birthday today. Yes, Todd is spending his podcast.
Yesterday, and the magic of recording time. Yeah, yes.
Well, Thursday. Thursday. So... yesterday.
And I'm sure we'll talk more about Halloween, but yes, there's Halloween.
Yes, there is Halloween. And, well, the spooky season got off to a smoggy start for a lot of our countries, including Bangkok right now, with the fine dust particles. That's just normal.
Yeah, I don't want to claim equivalency with the people who are feeling the haze really, really hard, and we're going to talk about that. But I think that's a kind of a universal experience for a lot of us. Is just that we're breathing some foul air.
Yeah.
And it's hitting. We're talking millions and millions of people now.
Right. And I understand that it's like been a recurring problem. But in the past few years, there's been a lot more media attention around it. So we're really noticing it.
It's one of those things. It's been a growing buzz, and then there's been a few years where it feels like some will is coalescing, and some new legislation is passed. And then it doesn't seem to have any effect. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit for a while, and then it goes back to what it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious to learn about what other countries are doing as we talk to our expert later today. Because in Thailand, what the government is doing is a lot of spraying water from top of the building, up tall buildings, or making fake
rain. Yeah, right. Why hasn't Indonesia thought of that?
Yeah.
Like the drones.
Right. So I'm just curious to see what other people are doing.
There's a lot of different blame assignment going on,
right,
and uncertainty of exactly where to point the fingers. Mm-hmm. But they all point back to us as consumers and the choices we make and the,
Southeast Asia hasn't always been so hip to recycling or getting active with climate change, but I think it's really changing with stuff like this happening.
Yeah, and the people involved them would say there just wasn't much awareness because people do care.
Mm-hmm.
People
didn't know about it. I didn't know about it until last year, not earlier this year when it started happening, and everyone was like, well, right now I'm experiencing, runny nose and a cough, even though I immediately just got better from a cold.
No, we've all been sick for weeks.
Right. And I think it's something I never thought about now has become a daily thing I experience.
Well, you know what else is a daily thing?
News.
The news.
Look at that transition.
Hong Kong began the week on pins and needles. As the mainland prepared for the People Republic's 70th birthday Tuesday, protesters pulled out all the stops to rain on China's National Day parade. In the end, it was one pivotal moment, a shot heard round the web the day will be remembered for. Anger has surged to new heights since Tuesday's shooting of high school student Cheung Chi-kin. Footage of the incident shows the 18-year-old among a group of protesters beating a cop they'd chased down in the Chin Wan neighborhood. That's when another officer charges gun drawn and shoots the student who was swinging a metal rod at him. It was the first time a demonstrator was struck with a live round in nearly 4 months of increasingly violent pro-democracy protests. Was the officer's use of force justified? Why didn't he use the beanbag rifle or pepper spray at his side? Those questions have mostly been drowned out by anger, which was compounded Tuesday afternoon when the teen protester was charged with rioting and assault, crimes for which he faces up to 12 years behind bars. At the time, Cheung was still recovering at a hospital after surgery to remove a bullet lodged 3 centimeters from his heart. The city has convulsed with protests against the police since Tuesday, and more mass rallies are expected this weekend.
She started as a singer and actress, then gained fame as one of the Philippines' first ever sex gurus.
Hey everyone, welcome to my blog, I'm Mocha, and we're here to talk to you about the G-Spot.
And now, Mocha Usan has been appointed to lead a government agency tasked with the well-being of millions. On Monday, the Philippines government announced that Mocha, a controversial supporter and maybe a little something-something of President Rodrigo Duterte, will head the Overseas Workers' Welfare Administration, which is in charge of about 2.3 million overseas workers. The appointment came just 4 months after Mocha's failed attempt at a political career when she couldn't win seats at the midterm elections. Okay, here's where we back up for a second and explain that the former singer shed her sexy image in 2016 when she became a vocal supporter of then-candidate Duterte. When he got elected, she became even more involved in politics and took a high-profile spokeswoman job in the president's communications office. Here's our associate editor in Manila, Rachel Melligat, about how people feel about her return to government.
Of course, her fans love her, and they have no problems with her. A lot of OFWs are happy that she was assigned to that position. But her critics, of course, pointed out the fact that she committed numerous public mistakes back when she was working for the communications office of the president. And they don't understand why and how come she keeps on getting promoted or keeps on getting assigned these high-profile government positions when the only thing that works to her favor is that she's a supporter of the president. She's pretty polarizing, to sum it up.
Mocha's time as government spokesperson famously included spreading false information about opposition senators and even Vice President Lenny Robredo. She was wildly disliked by the public, but her fall was sealed when she and a friend live-streamed themselves dancing and chanting euphemisms for breasts and vagina.
Where there's a will for porn, there's a way for porn. Singaporeans were both captivated and repulsed to find friends or even their own most intimate photos shared to an audience of tens of thousands this week. Though the city-state is famously stitched up when it comes to media controls, privacy-hardened services such as Telegram are providing new outlets for horny guys to get their creeper on. This time it was a private group engorged with more than 40,000 members called Nazi Lemang.
Like the rice dish?
Yeah, like that, but not. I asked Coconut Singapore managing editor Narul Azlia to explain that part.
We all know that it's a popular dish in Singapore and Malaysia, but it's also a term used by a lot of Malay men to describe the size of a woman's breast. So nasi lemak, sometimes they are sold in packets and they are wrapped in banana leaves, and the size and shape of this packet resembles a woman's breast. So if the packet is sold 50 cents, it's a smaller packet. If it's a $1 nasi lemak, then it's obviously a bigger packet. So men would say, for example, if a woman has a bigger breast, then they would say, oh, $1 nasi lemak. Or if this woman has a smaller breast, then it's okay, 50 cent nasi lemak, yeah.
So it was kind of like that infamous The Fappening leak of celeb nudes 5 years ago. But this time, mostly revenge porn of just purloined photos of private citizens.
Okay, moment of truth. Did you look at any of the Fappening photos?
Yeah, I admit I did look at some of them, and I told myself that it was a victimless crime. But the world's a different place now, and I fully get and own how shitty that is.
Well, did the admin group have like a mea culpa moment and apologize at least?
Not quite. In fact, the admin, username Glenn, said anyone complaining about their leaked photos could only blame themselves, he said. And I quote, he said, "You are the stupidest person to let your BF/GF take sexual videos," emphasis his, "to be leaked out all over the social media platform, not just Telegram. Stupid."
A classy response. Two's a pair. but three is a marriage. At least for one Malaysian man who wed not one, but two women at the same weekend ceremony that's going viral online. A cousin explained that the happy groom first met and got engaged to the first woman in his home state of Sabah. He later on went to work on a small island off the coast, where he met, as well as fell in love, with a second woman. Well, unable to choose between the two paramours, he decided, why not marry them both? To understand how common multiple marriages are in Muslim-majority Malaysia, we turn to Kuala Lumpur managing editor Jacqueline Raposo.
Well, multiple marriages are common and they're allowed in Islam. You can have up to four wives as long as the other wives have given you permission to do so and you can support all four of them equally. It is more rare to see a ceremony where two wives are getting married to the same husband at once. And I think that's mostly what caught the internet's attention. And maybe the fact that one of them didn't look so pleased to be there. I think most people online think that it's kind of amusing. The comments sort of range from speculations of what the wedding night will look like to people wondering why you would want double the headache of having more than one spouse. So, yep, I know there's not really any ill will about it, just a lot of people making jokes.
Thanks, Jacqueline. This week, we're also looking at an issue many of our readers and listeners know all too well. This time of year in Southeast Asia brings the end of Buddhist Lent, firewalking ceremonies, vegetarian festivals, Diwali, and more. For six decades, it's also meant filthy haze spreading from raging fires on the Indonesian islands of Borneo and Sumatra and into the lungs of millions. The health damage is real, as that haze blows west to shroud Singapore, Malaysia, and the deep south of Thailand in thick air pollution. Where there's smoke, there's fire, and every year fingers are pointed and promises made to stem the crisis. Whether it's small farmers or large corporate concerns sparking the blaze, fueling those fires is our insatiable demand for cheap palm oil. We reached out to Kim Stengert, World Wild Fund for Nature Singapore, for a download on why it keeps happening, who's to blame, and to find out if there's any reason to be hopeful.
There's a massive cost to it, of course. I mean, for one, of course, is the cost to human health. Respiratory problems are very common, of course, if it comes to prolonged haze episodes. That, of course, is getting worse and worse the closer you are to ground zero. Ground zero is most of the time for us Sumatra, Indonesia, where really the air quality is so bad that people need to get evacuated. Then you have, of course, massive economic costs. In 2015, tons of events had to be cancelled. Schools shut down for days. So there's immense cost on tourism, of course, as well. People trying not to fly into the region. So it's the perfect storm, actually.
You know, this isn't global warming. This isn't climate change. This isn't something that some people can pretend isn't happening. It's a big, smoky, fiery mess. Who's to blame?
Connected. If we're looking for culprits on the ground, who sets the fires? It's a mix of a couple of things. We've seen large-scale concessions burn by the big companies that could be caused, and that's really, really difficult to pinpoint. Was that someone from a big company, or was that encroachment by someone from the community? Reality is there's also a lot of land conflicts in Indonesia. Business that thinks they own a concession, but then the community thinks they own the concession, and then it's just put on fire. Because both parties are really not getting along.
I just want to verify I understand correctly. You're saying that private parties involved in land conflicts may just burn out the land punitively?
Well, sometimes that happens. The other thing as well is if the land rights are not really clear on who owns this land, then no one is going to go in and stop the fire. So there's, for example, there's a very clear law in Indonesia that if your concession is burning, you've got to go and stop the fires. It doesn't matter who started them. Unfortunately, what we see from our analysis, that's not happening fast enough. The big, big problem around these fires is, I mean, most of us imagine, you know, like the wildfires you would see in California or somewhere else, big areas of forests burning, large red flames. The reality, what we're fighting in Sumatra is mostly peatland fires. So peatland is usually wet and somewhat composed organic matter. Now, during a dry spell, all of the soil, the peat soil, dries up, and all of these, you know, little twigs, half decomposed organic materials are starting to burn, and they burn underground, sometimes 10, 15 meters deep. So the only thing, if you let a fire escalate and you're not there enough quickly to put it out, the only thing that can help you in the end is actually massive amounts of rain coming in to put out these fires and really soak, you know, meters of layers of soil until they get to the burning area deep underground.
Can you articulate to me in as simple a way as you can why, I mean, we established this is a 60-year running problem. Why does it seem intractable? Why does it seem like there's no light at the end of this tunnel?
Yeah, so I think the problem keeps happening just simply because we have a massive demand for very cheap palm oil, and palm oil already is one of the very cheap oils that is available, and a huge demand for very cheap pulp and paper products at the same time. And the most destructive way is usually the cheapest way to produce these products. So you could clear land technically with different things, but it's much cheaper and much faster just to burn it. So I think it's a lot around producing as much as possible, as cheaply as possible, and consumers not being fully aware of what they're actually paying for.
And then is it a lack of political will? Is it weak law enforcement? Is it corruption? Or is it, as we get in Southeast Asia, a basket of all these issues that are keeping change from happening?
It's unfortunately a basket of all of these. And, you know, emphasis is a little bit different depending on which region you go. But we've seen pretty much everything that you've mentioned. There's illegal palm oil entering global supply chains, as we see, that's grown in protected areas. We've seen corruption cases, problems with enforcement, of course, just looking at the sheer scale of how much land that would need it to be policed. It's all of these things coming together. And there's really, again, positive signs on how to solve it, but we need, you know, political will and will of businesses to move this forward.
One last thing, and this is just a thought, and maybe outside of your wheelhouse, but any, you know, given the effect upon neighboring nations, has any greater legal action?
There's some. So in 2015, Singapore put in a new piece of legislation, which is called the Transboundary Haze Pollution Act, which basically would allow, the government or any entity to sue a company that is responsible for causing haze in Singapore. There was investigations into a couple of companies, and they were called out actually by the Ministry of Water and Environment Resources in Singapore back in 2015. I think, unfortunately, it's just really, really hard to get all the evidence in place because you're talking about something that is happening in a different country but impacts your own. So we haven't seen any conviction under that act, but we know investigations are ongoing. So we do hope that is part of the solution.
Anything else that you want to say or that we should know about this or that is...
Yeah, I think that it would be really great if you highlight to your listeners that it's really, really important for us as consumers, as the general public, to raise our voice, to make sure we demand for businesses to do the right thing and to produce products sustainably, and do question if something can be produced in the most environmentally and health friendly manner if it is the cheapest product on the shelf, and if we need to shift a little bit of our consumption patterns. If we want to continue breathing clean air, it's also in our duty to, you know, keep businesses accountable and look at what we're buying on a daily basis.
Gotcha. And does that burden on the consumer, is that an equally distributed thing, or is that more of a first world where most of the consumption and the potential for it to change is taking place? Or are we talking in the neighboring countries where people are choking on the haze?
So the tragic thing really is that the availability of sustainable palm oil or sustainable pulp and paper products, although they are produced in our neighboring countries, but the availability on, I would say, supermarket shelves, for example, is lowest in our countries. Most of the sustainable products are exported to, I guess, the Western world, so Europe or the US, where there is a larger demand than we have it in our region, which is you know, really a tragic if you think that we're suffering from all the negative consequences at the same time. So we really need collective effort in clamping down on unsustainable development. And I think, you know, the great thing is there are solutions to all of these problems. It can be done sustainable. We don't have to say no to consuming or really all go into minimalism or other extreme measures.
You're saying we don't have to all live off celery froth?
There's obviously certain things that we need to really stop doing or consume smarter than the way we do it today. But if you look at food production, it's one of the biggest drivers of environmental destruction. WWF is working, first of all, on certification in many cases. So there is alternative options that are grown sustainably. You can go and buy certified sustainable palm oil products. You can buy certified sustainable pulp and paper products. You can see them easily by the FSC logo, for example, for paper, or the RSPO logo for palm oil. We go in, we speak to the community, try to come up with fire-free policies, try to provide alternative livelihoods so that instead of cutting down the forest for a plantation, they can earn their money by protecting the forest. We've recently just concluded an emergency fundraising campaign to provide firefighting equipment to the local community so that they can proactively go out and stop these fires before they escalate. So there's a lot of demand. But one of the big problems is just that you're talking about millions of hectares that you're trying to keep safe. And that's a really
just difficult sheer scope. Yeah.
Yeah. So sheer scope. So you really need companies to really go ahead and invest in sustainability and be clear and try to clear path forward that these kind of practices have to stop. And at the same time, you need the governments to really make sure that the laws are enforced. And that the right policy measures are taken to stop this disruptive behavior.
Well, our guest today was Kim Stengert with the Worldwide Fund for Nature. Kim, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Tom.
All right, folks. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Coconuts Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Spotify,
Apple Podcasts, Google,
Ooshka.
I think it's pretty much everywhere.
Yeah,
now.
Just search us up.
And you know, it really helps spread the word if you write a two word review. I'm trying to think what the love it. That's the shortest review I can think of.
Love.
Or just rad, one word,
yeah.
Some kind of review.
Hit up with your thoughts.
Helps more people to hear the podcast, helps us, and we appreciate that. Stay tuned to coconuts.co for the updates on these stories and everything else new and fun going on. And we will see you next week.
From Coconuts, Bangkok, my name's Tara Kamol-Davis.
And I'm Todd Reese.
Special thanks this week to our audio engineer, Indigo Manthagon at Noise Studio, where you can record your podcasts, interviews, voiceovers, or even get your soundtracks produced.
The Coconuts Podcast is written and produced by Todd Reese and Tara Kamal-Watanabe. Our executive producers are Byron Perry and Chad Williams.
Thank you for tuning in, and see you next week.